All right.
Okay. This is Megan Kennedy interviewing Mr. Larry Bly. So, Mr. Bly, what was your favorite meal you've ever cooked on Cooking Cheap?
Right out the gate, you got me. I don't know. I cooked over 300 recipes in 25 years, I think it was, on the air. Whether there was a favorite or not, I don't know. It wasn't a dessert, I can tell you that, because I'm not a dessert person. I don't do too much of that. I guess probably some Italian dishes we tried, yeah.
And then are there any recipes that to this day you've kept to yourself?
Absolutely. We put out something called the Cookin' Cheap Cookbook. In fact, we put out three of them down through the years, but the last one was especially a nice one with a sort of a semi-hard cover and a color photo on the front. And I have that at home, and there are like five or six recipes that I know are in there that if I'm going to fix them, I'm always going to go to that book and get them, yeah.
And what are those recipes?
Well, there is a chicken parmesan recipe that's very simple but very elegant that I like an awful lot. It doesn't require a lot of fuss. You know, the show was about fixing foods that didn't require a lot of fuss and simple recipes. There's a beer bread that I do occasionally from scratch that's very, very simple but quite lovely. And let's see, there might be, I'm trying to think of one or two others that I might go to for that. But for right now, that's all I can think of.
And then can you tell us a little bit about your childhood in Maryland?
Well, I was born in Baltimore, Maryland, but I did not live there but a year because my parents divorced. And the one thing they could agree on in their divorce was that I should be raised by somebody in the country and not be raised in Baltimore, which was a very, very rough city back in the day, and some parts of it still are, for that matter. So they trotted me out to Shenandoah County in Northern Virginia, where my grandmother lived, and the only thing they could agree on is that she should raise me. I don't think either of them wanted me. I'm not sure about that, but anyway. So they took me out to my grandmother's house to be taken care of, and she died of cancer a year later. So my Aunt Treva Kopp, my Aunt Tootsie, took me on at that point, along with her younger sister, who still had one more year to go in high school when her mother died, and my grandfather. So we were this crazy family of, you know, aunts and uncles and nephews and what have you. And so I grew up on a 300-acre farm, beef cattle farm near Winchester. And it was a beautiful life. It was a wonderful life. And I was never, my folks would visit me, but I never ever lived with them again after that. I literally grew up there. And my folks gave me the opportunity to be adopted. And I said, no, I don't think we need to do that. So I kept my name and was never officially adopted, but they were my official guardians all through school and college. Yeah.
And can you elaborate about your living or your life living on a farm in Winchester, Virginia?
Well, it was a lot of work because farms are a lot of work, and so you were expected to, you know, to work out in the barn and in the fields and what have you. And for an only child like myself, one of the reasons I think that I came around to the creative field was because I had to amuse myself so much. I was by myself so much of the time. But it was a lovely place to grow up. We had, you know, 300 acres, probably 500 cows. And the first thing you learn on a beef cattle farm is do not name the animals. That's a terrible thing, but it's true. So, I was, of course, lived there until I went into the Army. I lived there through college, and I lived there through I went away for 2 years, but I came back from the Army, back to the house briefly, and then I moved away for good, you know.
How did serving in the Army during the Korean War impact your life?
Well, first of all, I wasn't there during the Korean War, because if I had been there during the Korean War, I would have been 7 years old. Gotcha. But to answer your question, I was in Korea during the Vietnam War. Okay, that is very confusing to people. It's not the first time people have done articles on me saying Mr. Bly served admirably during the Korean War, and I always go, no, I would have been the youngest soldier in the world. No, but anyway, I went in. I was very lucky. I got drafted in 68. And it was very stressful because it was almost a given that you were going to go to Vietnam and maybe get killed. So it was very stressful for all of us that age. But I lucked out. I ended up going to Fort Bragg, North Carolina for basic training. And when I got finished with basic training, they had assigned all these people, you're going to go to Fort Polk, Louisiana, and you're going to go to the da-da-da-da-da, and you knew that these people would definitely end up in Vietnam, and those people might, and what have you. And when we got to the end of the list, I'm standing there by myself, and a guy says, "Who are you?" And I said, "Private Bly." And he says, "I don't have anything for you at all." And I went, "Oh, lucky me. Everybody else knows where they're going and what they're doing." So anyway, they came and got me an hour later and says, "Well, actually, you're not going anywhere. You're going to go to the other side of the base, where you're going to be in the Psychological Operations Division, PSYOPs." And it was our job. We were photographers and radio announcers and TV people and newspaper journalists. And they just bunched us into this big company because we were a group of creative people. They didn't know what to do with us. So we had the Green Berets on one side of us, and we had the 82nd Airborne Division on the other side. But we were this strange little company of really fun people. I mean, we were just, you know, we were the people that did all the writing and all of the broadcasting, all that stuff. So my experience at Fort Bragg was really good, and I'd been there for a year. And the policy at the time was, if I get to wandering on too much, just stop me. If you had less than 13 months left, they would not send you overseas. Well, with 11 months left, they came in one day and says, "You're going overseas." And I says, "No way." And he says, "You're the luckiest guy in the world. You're not going to Vietnam. You're going to go to Korea." And in Korea, they got me on with the American Forces Korea Network, and I was a network announcer. And I always like to say that I helped make Korea safe for rock and roll. And that's what I did. So it was quite enjoyable, thank you. It was like a real job, by the way.
And then how did you become a part of the Army?
What do you mean part of the Army?
Like, how did you, get there? Like, how did you, come to serving in the Army?
Well, the draft board, that's how. Yeah, it's not something I wanted to do, but mm-hmm. It was something that happened to you as a young male when you graduated from high school. Either you went directly into college, or you found yourself trying to figure out, if you didn't want to go, how you might get out of it. Although I didn't try to do that. I got called to by the draft board to have an Army physical, and that starts the process. Okay. And strangely enough, that process started right here, two blocks from here.
And then what sparked your move to Roanoke, Virginia in 1971?
In 71, I had just gotten back from the Army, and I went back home for about 3 or 4 months, and I went back to my radio job that I had before I went in the Army. I was a disc jockey. And I decided, you know, if I land here, I'm just liable to never leave here, because I love the farm and I love my folks. I have a wonderful family. And I have got to force myself out again. And it wasn't like I hadn't been gone for 2 years. So I thought, if I stay here, it's not a good thing. I need to move on to something else. So I went to Detroit, Michigan. I moved to Detroit, Michigan, where I worked for a big radio station up there for about 4 months. And I hated Detroit, Michigan. Detroit had just had riots. They had burned half the city down. It was a nasty place. It was just really edgy. A little too edgy for this country boy. So I started putting out what are called air checks to different radio stations, a couple in Washington, because I kind of grew up outside of D.C. One here to WROV, and one to a station in Charlotte, North Carolina. And all of them responded positively. And so I thought that I was going to go to Charlotte, North Carolina, but the job didn't come open until fall. And I didn't want to stay in Detroit till fall. So I had a friend who worked for WROV, and he says, well, why don't you come work for us? It's a really great radio station. Be shocked at how good this little radio station is in Roanoke, Virginia. And he says, I don't think you'll mind Roanoke too bad. So I said, okay, I'll do that. So that's how I ended up moving here. And I never made it to Charlotte, North Carolina. I'm still here.
And then how would you describe your social life when you first moved to Roanoke in the early 70s?
My social life was non-existent, even though I was in radio. And I wasn't yet in TV. I would not get into TV for 3 or 4 more years. So strictly radio. And then my business partner and I, Marty Hull, and I, also at that very time started the ad agency sort of on the side to see if we could make that eventually be our what we do for a living. So when I first moved here in 71, I didn't really, even though I made fabulous money in Detroit, I didn't make fabulous money in Roanoke. So I didn't have a social life. We had a cabin on Back Creek, a very beautiful place. It's still there. And so I worked 7 to midnight. When I got off at midnight, there was nothing open in Roanoke except maybe a truck stop down on 220. So I would just come home. And it wasn't much of a party in person. So I had no social life. And then eventually, social life started to happen. I started meeting, through my business partner, Marty Hull, I started, because he had worked here for many years, so he knew a lot of people. So he started introducing me to people who would eventually, some of whom would become my long-term friends in this town. And then I started getting invited to parties and social events, but I still didn't go out. Like to bars.
Okay.
I didn't do that. Not initially.
And then how has your personal life changed since the early 1970s?
I've gotten old. Not much, I don't think. I really don't think so. Of course, I've been very successful both in all of my pursuits. I've been very lucky. I've been very successful. And so I live comfortably, not ostentatiously, but comfortably. And I think that I live a good life. And I'm still working at this ad agency, even though I don't really need to anymore, just to sort of give me a place to go to every day. I like having my desk and my phone and my studio. We still record stuff here. And Lindy and I handle some accounts, and so yeah, we stay busy. And so my life has changed in that I'm now doing this not because I have to, but because I still very much enjoy what I've done all these years.
What has sparked your interest in broadcasting at such an early age?
You know, that's an interesting question. My folks could never figure it out. Years ago, the Advertising Federation of the Roanoke Valley gave me the Silver Medal Award, which is given every couple of years, not necessarily every year, for excellence in the field. It could be broadcasting, it could be advertising, whatever. And so it's given by your peers, it's voted on by your peers, and it's a lovely thing to have. And they gave me one in 1989, and they did a 30-minute program of my life. It was like, this is your life. It's amazing. And some of my folks told a story about how when I was a kid, I would take like pan lids and I would spin them and sing songs. So I think I thought I was a disc jockey, even though I didn't know what a disc jockey was. And I was always fascinated with radio. And my Aunt Tootsie, who raised me, was just a big radio fan. And she was, oddly enough, to listen to rock music all the time, which was strange. I mean, we grew up in the country. We had, if you went to the barn, you listened to country music. But not in my Aunt Tootsie's kitchen, you didn't listen to country music. So I got a very, plus when I was a kid, at night, there were a lot of big 50,000-watt radio stations that you could listen to that will only come in after dark because after the sun goes down, it radiates differently. So I grew up very early on listening to WABC in New York, which was a great rock station, WLS in Chicago, WKBW Buffalo, WoWo in Fort Wayne. All these stations just came barreling in, and these disc jockeys were just funny and wonderful, and the music was very exciting. So I sort of got that at a very early age, even though I was on a farm. Mm-hmm. So I think I was influenced to do that. And somehow I just grew this voice one day. I had no training. It just happened.
And then how do you feel being described as a wacky radio guy?
Well, I like being described as a wacky radio guy, because back in the day when we were on the air, it was our job not only to inform you, but it was our job also to make you laugh and make you, you know, especially when you're getting up in the morning. I was a morning man for a couple of years, and while I hated getting up at 5 to do that job, I'm told that I made it a little easier for other people to get up and go to their work. So, yeah, I like being a wacky guy, you know, because we really did do some outrageous things on the air that made people laugh, and we gave away thousands of dollars worth of prizes, and it was great fun. It really was.
Can you tell us a little bit about what you talked about on your radio show?
Well, it wasn't a talk radio show. It was a music radio show. So mostly it was just what we call one-liners and jokes and stuff like that. And no, I can't remember any of them, and you should be grateful that I can. They probably weren't that funny now that I think about it.
And then what made you switch from broadcasting and being on the radio, TV, to starting up your own advertising agency?
Well, it kind of happened, as I mentioned a while ago, it kind of all happened at the same time. I knew that I loved radio. It was and is my first love. But I also knew that in order to make more and more money on radio, I had to keep moving to bigger and bigger cities. And I'm not much of a vagabond. And so I wanted to just kind of settle in and have a life. And so my business partner, Marty Hall, and I, he was also a radio guy, so he understood what my feelings were. And he says, if we can start this ad agency, eventually it will be our livelihood, and then you don't have to do the broadcasting. And it worked out that way. But as with so many other things in my life, I never stopped doing any of it. So I continued doing weekends on the air for years, up until about 10 years ago. Then I did a public radio show for a big band swing show for about 3 years. That was a few years back. And then, of course, the TV shows. But all of it, I did all of them simultaneously. I was a very busy man in the 80s. I spent a lot of time running from studio to studio, from microphone to microphone. And I was really busy, but I loved it. It was a labor of love.
How was your experience as host of America's longest-running cooking show?
How was my experience? Is that the question?
Yes.
Well, it was always fun. Laban and I could be having a little argument, and we didn't do that very often, or we could be having a very big argument as we're preparing to go on the air. And when they said, gave us the 10-second countdown, and we went on, it wasn't fake. We just immediately started liking each other again and laughing. We could always make each other laugh, even when we were angry with each other. So it was always pleasure. It was a lot of fun. It really was. It was never one of those jobs that got to be a chore.
And then, in your opinion, what made the show successful?
The show worked on a whole bunch of different levels. If you've ever seen it. Have you ever seen it?
Mm-hmm.
You can go on YouTube. It's all over the place. The show worked on a lot of different levels. It was two guys. It had a lot of things going on. Kids liked the show because they thought we were like Laurel and Hardy. Adults liked it because it was just a funny show. It was very funny. And it was not scripted. We were just two funny guys. He made me laugh. I made him laugh. And there was all this, college kids liked it because they would get together on campus, and because it was, I guess it was kind of, they thought it was funny for a lot of different reasons. Straights and gays, for different reasons, liked it because there was sort of maybe this little underlying thing that once in a while we would get a little bitchy with each other on the air, you know, and that tickled, you know, everybody. So yeah, it was successful because it worked on so many levels. Old people liked it because they just embraced us. They just thought we were wonderful.
What is your favorite project that you've been a part of?
I did make a couple of notes in case I had to talk about it. I think it wasn't my favorite project, but it was the longest lasting project that I had, was starting the helping to establish the Blue Ridge Aid Support Services, or GRASS, through the Council of Community Services. I've done a lot of, you know, gratis work the agency has. I have personally served on a lot of boards and have volunteered a lot of time for the rescue mission and various places. But I was called upon in, I guess, the early 90s, and I can't remember what year it was. I just know it was after I'd lost about 15 friends to AIDS. I was called upon by the Council of Community Services to help create something, and they weren't really kind of sure what it was. It turned out to be BRASS, Blue Ridge 8 Support Services, and what it was is we assisted people with AIDS and HIV positive to get housing and pay utilities and apply for various programs, including the Ryan White Fund, which is to this day is a very big fund to help people out. So we essentially were a clearinghouse for people living with AIDS to find resources to survive if they were having a tough time. And I was the president of BRASS for probably, I think, 2 years. And then I served on the board, I think, for 15, until we finally went out of business, gratefully. And not for the right reasons. We went out of business because essentially the state of Virginia was in a better position to administrate some of these programs than a volunteer organization was. And so one day they said, well, you know, the state has come to us and said, you can be a part of us or we can be a part of you, but frankly, we'd like for you to be a part of us. And I looked at the board and said, why would we do that? They don't need us. And so we essentially voted ourselves out of existence. But a lot of these programs are still there. But anyway, to get back to the point of your question, that's not one of the more fun things I ever did, but it was certainly one of the longer lasting and probably accomplished more than a lot of anything else that I ever did. Okay. Yeah.
And then what are your plans for the future of Cooking Cheap?
There are no plans for the future of Cooking Cheap. Having said that, that's not entirely true. Nothing is ever black and white with me. I'm all shades of gray. I have this gentleman in Charlottesville, David Dulant, I think is his name, strange last name, who contacted me 3 years ago. He was a big fan of the show. He grew up watching the show with his mother, who was a big fan of the show. And he says, I run a production house, and I think I'd like to convince you to go back in front of the cameras again and see if we can bring this show back. And I says, yeah, David, it's been off the air for 15 years. I'm not, you know, not getting any younger. I'm not sure I want to do this. I did it for 25 years. That's a long time in TV. It took him 3 years of coming to Roanoke and to convince me to do this. So last fall, I packed up all the pots and pans and food and everything and got myself a hotel room in Charlottesville, and they had found a house with a nice kitchen, and he hired a camera crew, and we got another person whose name I cannot remember from outside of D.C. to be my co-host, and we sort of clicked. I don't know whether we clicked as well as Laban and I did. So anyway, we actually did a pilot last fall, and he is taking this pilot and is talking to syndicators right now to see if there's any interest. So your question actually is more fortuitous than you thought, perhaps. No, but my personal plans is I would just like to let it die. I put in 25 years. It was a lot of fun. That's in my past.
What is your involvement in the LGBTQ community?
None whatsoever. Having said that, gosh, do I ever give a straight answer to anything? I don't think I ever do. That's not entirely true. Before it was the LGBT, what is it?
LGBT.
Yeah, I can never remember. Now they've added three more. It's the alphabet. Before there was that, I helped to organize, along with some friends here in town, the first Pride in the Park, which was held at Wasena Park the first 2 or 3 years, and the first Gay Pride Parade in Roanoke. I had already participated in some of the first ones in Washington, D.C., which was terrible for me because my partner at the time says, oh, we've got to do this. He was all about it. He still is. He's a friend now, but he's still out there, you know, working everything that comes along. He said, we've got to make this march. And I said, are you kidding? It'll be covered by local TV and my family will be watching local TV. I don't think I want to do this. Well, we did anyway. So anyway, in answer to your question, even before the organization per se came around, I was in on sort of the vanguard, I guess, of trying to help organize some things like that here in town. And in fact, worked in some of those projects for 3 or 4 years. And then they got to be big and other people took them over gladly, and they did them better than we did them. And so, but that's the answer, I guess.
Can you tell us a little more about that?
About what?
About the things that you've started here and that people have taken over.
Well, of course, Brass was one of them, okay. Blue Ridge Aid Support Services. The Pride in the Park, the parade. I'm trying to think if there's anything else. Nothing comes to mind right off the bat. I'm sure after you leave, I'll think of something, and I'm sorry about that. I wish I were a little better prepared.
And then explain how you feel being a role model to not only the LGBT community, but to Roanoke Valley as a whole.
Oh, am I a role model? Oh, my gosh, that's scary. That's what I think about that. I think it's scary. Oh, I suppose it's an honor. I suppose it is because I've worked on so many levels and so many different things. So yeah, it's an honorable thing. It is.
Is there anything else in your life that has impacted you that we did not already touch on that you would like to share with us?
Well, yeah, I think that I touched on it ever so briefly. That impacted me mightily was when I started losing friends in the latter 80s and early 90s to something that we didn't know what it was called AIDS. That was a very scary time. And I lost about 15 friends in about 2 or 3 years, which was a pretty terrible thing. And then I would go on to lose friends for another 15 years, including my business partner, whom I got to watch die of AIDS up close and personal for a couple of years. Horrible thing to see. So yeah, that impacted me mightily. I'm trying to think if there's anything else. There would hardly be anything that could compare to that, I can assure you. So yeah.
And that's all we have.
That's it? That's the best you can do?
Yes.
Is there anything else you'd like to share with us?
Yeah, I'm going to tell you a funny story. Can I tell you a funny story? Okay, because I didn't know. I made some notes so I wouldn't forget some. See, I have very little history here because I didn't grow up here. But I was on my way in here this morning. I went, oh, my gosh. I forgot to put down this very funny story about my first time at Roanoke, Virginia. In fact, my first 2 times at Roanoke, Virginia. I was probably 18 years old when I first came here for an Army physical at the Carlton Terrace building, which they tore down a few years ago over on Jefferson Street, right beside Carillion, the big hospital just across the street from here. So anyway, we came down on the Greyhound bus. It was like cattle. They'd load all of us guys up in Woodstock, and then they'd stop several stops on the way down. So you had a busload of people who were going to be going to their Army physical. And for some reason, even up in the valley, we didn't go into D.C. or Baltimore. We came here to Roanoke. This was the regional area to have our Army physical. So the first night, they put us up in the Patrick Henry Hotel, which is now just the Patrick Henry. This is a funny story. So they put us, the Army must have gotten one heck of a deal from Patrick Henry. They put us on the top floor, which had nothing. 2 beds, a table, and a telephone. There was no television. There was no radio. There was nothing. I mean, it was just this bare room. Because we were going to go in early the next morning for our Army physicals. So, you know, we're all nervous because we might be sent to Vietnam and killed. And so I couldn't sleep. So I opened up the window of the Patrick Henry Hotel on the top floor, where you could do things back in those days. Didn't have any safety stuff like they do today. And I'm sitting up there, and it's 1 o'clock in the morning, which is late for me. And I'm looking down on Bullitt Avenue, which is right in front of this building, but it used to go all the way across before they put the interstate in. But if you go on the other side of the interstate, Bullitt Avenue is still there, right in front of the Patrick Henry. So it's Bullitt and Jefferson. So I'm sitting up there, and I'm just a country boy, dumb as a post, And I'm looking down and I'm going, what are all of these people doing out here at this time? Why aren't they in bed? Why don't they go to bed? What are they doing? And there are people racing up and down, you know, there's a big parking garage next to it and people racing in and out of the parking garage and all this nonsense. I didn't know until many years later, and it happened again 2 years later when I came down for another physical. That time they put me in the Army. But what I didn't know until many years later, after I moved to Roanoke and got to know people that grew up here, was that was the gay cruising block. I didn't know what all this craziness was down below me. I thought, what? I guess people were picking people up or getting to know people. I didn't even know what that was. It had to be explained to me. But I thought that was very funny. My first two times in Roanoke, that's what I saw. And I'm trying to think if there's anything else that I would like to impart to you. Just give me a second. But I did think about that. Did we go into the bars, all the bars? Has anybody told you about how many bars we had here?
Yes.
Oh, my gosh. A real long list of them. And supposedly the trade ones was supposedly the first one in the state. I find that a little hard to believe, but anyway. So anyway, I think that's pretty much, I can't think of anything else that I wanted to tell you. I'm surprised that you didn't ask me about the Cook sisters. Do you know about the Cook sisters?
No.
Well, let me tell you this. The Cook sisters was a part of Cook and Cheap. Mm-hmm. And it was Laban and me in drag. And it wasn't pretty, I can tell you that. It was old woman funny drag, okay? But here's how it came about. The TV station came to us. We put the show on air. It was an immediate hit. And about 3 or 4 years later, somebody at the station came down and said to Laban and me, said, well, you know, this is public TV, and at one time was called educational TV. And while your show is very funny, it doesn't impart anything other than humor. A lot of kids watching, a lot of people. Don't you think you could come up with a segment where maybe you could give some tips or something, and, you know, household tips, cooking tips, what have you? And we said, well, that sounds kind of dull and dry to us. And I said, well, you know, we think you ought to get something a little educational on the show instead of just doing it for laughs. So Laban and I got together one evening. We came up with the idea of the Cook sisters. We said, what if we have these two old Bettys in a really bad drag, and they give cooking tips or, you know, cleaning tips or what have you, but they do it for laughs, as we did everything else, because we thought that to just stop and do that would kill the forward motion of the show, you know. So we came up with Cook sisters and two wonderful outfits, and, well, they just became an immediate hit. I thought, we'll do this for a year, you know. I don't want to appear on TV in a dress very long, because I'm running an ad agency, you know. Well, the Cook sisters just took off. People loved them. They thought they were funny. They were named Tootsie Cook, after my Aunt Tootsie, who raised me, and Sister Cook, after Laban's Aunt Sister. That was her name, Aunt Sister. How crazy is it? So anyway, they became a huge hit, and the TV station just had a fit. Management came to us and says, this really wasn't quite what we had in mind. And we said, well, this is what you got. Either go with that or we're not going to do this. So, and then they became so popular we couldn't get rid of them. So they stayed with the show for the entire rest of the run. That was the only part of the show, by the way, that was pre-taped, because obviously we couldn't jump into an outfit on the air. The show was done in real time, beginning to end, just like this interview is. No stops, no edits. 27 minutes from the time they pointed the finger and gave us a 10-second countdown. So the only way we could do the Cook sisters was to pre-record it. So we would do an entire season's worth of one sitting. We would do it sometimes on my back deck. Sometimes we did it at someone's home. And we did all 13 for the 13, or 26 for the 26 series. And so we would just call on it and they just bring it up. But it was the only part of the show that was ever taped. But yeah, to this day, and I'll tell you a very funny story. One day I'm sitting at the Waffle House on Franklin Road reading the newspaper, and some big burly truck driver comes in and sits down beside me, and I can see him sort of looking at me, the corner of his eye, and I thought, oh boy, this ought to be really interesting. And he says, you that guy on that cooking show? I said, yeah. He says, you were Larry. I said, yeah. He says, I just got to tell you, those daggone Cook sisters are the funniest thing. Something you wouldn't expect to hear from a truck driver. But, you know, so it just had this universal universal appeal, I guess. So that's how they came to be. Because if you didn't have that on there, someone would ask you about that, okay?
Thank you.
Yes, thank you so much.
Well, you all were just too much fun and such a pleasure. I